And now, from the gleaming spires of Chicago, broadcasting to Niflheim, Svartalfheim, Olympus, throughout the nine worlds and beyond, the only Thor podcast hosted by a true descendant of Odin. You are tuned to the immortal sounds of Radio Free Asgard.
You are tuned to Radio Free Asgard, episode number 171. Skirnir's Journey. Frey had no business to be in Odin's hall, Valaskjalf, and he had no right at all to sit in the high seat, Hlidskjalf, and look out over all the worlds. That was the right only of Odin and his wife Frigg. Frey narrowed his eyes and looked north into Jotunheim. What did he see? A large, handsome hall belonging to the giant Gyrmir. And what did he see next? A woman coming out of this hall. Her name was Gerd. She was Gymir's daughter. She seemed to be made of light, or clothed in sparkling light. When she raised her arms to close the hall doors, the dome of the sky and the sea surrounding the earth at once grew brighter. Because of her, all the worlds were hidden in a flash of brilliant, icy light. Frey looked and longed. The more he looked, the more he was unable not to look. His eyes burned like fireballs. His only desire was to win Gerd. Frey gazed at her until she had crossed a courtyard into her own hall. The worlds grew shadowy, and the god lowered his eyes. Then he left Hlidskjalf and crept out of the hall. The god of the world paid for presuming to sit in Hlidskjalf. He ached with an endless, sad longing. He spoke to no one, and wanted no one to speak to him. He could not sleep, he did not want to eat, he did not want to drink. He could neither escape his fierce desire, nor see how to satisfy it. Njord, Frey's father, became concerned with his son. He called for Frey's servant, Shining Skirnir, and told him, "Go and ask my son what has upset him. Why is he so angry, or else so sad that he will not even share his feelings and set them free?" "I will ask him that," said Skirnir, "but I won't like the answer." Skirnir approached Frey and said to him, "First of the gods, why must you stay here in your hall day in and day out, without food or drink or sleep? Why do you shun company?"
"What good would it do?" said Frey. "No amount of talk can help. Nothing can blunt this anguish. And what if the elf beams do shine every day? My mind is full of gloom."
"There is no grief so great that you cannot tell it to me," said Skirnir. "We were children together. We've always trusted one another." Then Frey unlocked his word hoard. He told Skirnir how he had seen Gerd from Hlidskjalf, and how she brightened the nine worlds with her radiance, and how he longed for her.
"No man," he said, "has ever loved a woman as I love her, and no god would ever agree to our union."
Skirnir listened and nodded.
"Go," said Frey. "Whether her father likes it or not, bring her to me here and I'll give you great rewards."
Skirnir smiled. "Give me the horse that follows its nose through the dark and will not bridle at magic flickering flames. And give me the sword that will fight against giants of its own accord." Then Frey handed over two of his greatest treasures. He lived to regret that. At Ragnarok, a sword to ward off the fire demon Surt would have been handy. Skirnir mounted and made off at once. As he galloped out of Frey's courtyard, his horse's hooves struck fire from the paving stones. He came to the banks of the Eving in the early evening. Skirnir was ferried across the river into Jotunheim, and then night fell. "Can you feel this darkness pressing against us?" said Skirnir to the horse, and they galloped across lifeless flatland. "Now we must head for the fells where the frost giants live. You and I share the same fate. We'll either get home again quickly, or we'll fall into the hands of some dreadful troll." Skirnir rode through the night, and during the night he and his mount galloped up a mountain pass and came to a curtain of fire. Frey's horse did not even break its pace and galloped straight through the searing magic flames. At daybreak, Skirnir, the Shining One, came down into a saucer of land covered with sour, gray grass. It was a loveless kind of place, surrounded by desolate hills that welled like breasts and were pocked by outcrops of rock. In the middle of this depression stood Gymir's hall, and next to it his daughter Gerd's hall, guarded by a fence. A pair of hounds were chained to the gateposts, and they were not pleasant. Skirnir looked around and saw a single herdsman sitting way up on the hillside. He turned away from the halls and rode up to him. "Nothing escapes your eye," Skirnir said, "sitting here on this hill. Tell me, how can I muzzle those hounds and enter Gerd's hall?" The herdsman looked at Skirnir and said stonily, "Are you doomed to die, or are you dead already? There's no way in which you can talk to Gymir's daughter this year or next year or ever." Skirnir could see that the herdsman did not mean to help him. He wheeled away without more ado, and as he galloped down the slope again, he called out over his shoulder, "Fearlessness is better than a faint heart for any man who puts his nose out of doors. The length of my life and the day of my death were fated long ago." In her hall, fair Gerd heard the coming and going, barking and shouting, and asked her servant, "What is all that noise that echoes round these walls? The ground shakes, the hall itself shudders." "A man outside the fence. He's dismounting now, and now he has set his horse to graze." "Welcome him then," said Gerd coldly. "My heart says this visitor is my brother's murderer. Nevertheless, tell him a horn of mead awaits him in this hall." So Skirnir passed unharmed between the disappointed hounds and walked into the hall. It was colder in there than he would have wished. Dressed entirely in white, Gerd came forward to welcome him.
"Are you one of the elves or one of the gods? How are you able to pass through the flickering flames to these halls?"
"I'm no elf," said Skirnir, "and I'm no god, although it's true that I've come through the fire curtain." He looked at Gerd and dipped his hands into the pockets of his cloak.
"These," he said, "these are 11 of the apples of youth. They're yours, Gerd. I'll give them all to you if you'll promise yourself to Frey and call him your darling dear." "Never," said Gerd icily. "No one is going to buy my love with golden apples and promises of youth. And however long we live, Frey and I will never share one roof."
Skirnir reached into the pocket of his cloak again.
"I've brought you this arm ring," he said. "It is Draupnir. Long ago, Odin placed it on Baldur's pyre. 8 rings of its own weight drop from it on every 9th night." "Be that as it may, I have no wish for it," said Gerd, and her voice chilled Skirnir to the marrow. "There's wealth enough in Gymir's hall."
Skirnir continued to smile. "You see this honed and gleaming sword here in my hand? I am going to hack off your head unless you do as I ask."
"Force will get Frey nowhere," said Gerd. Her cold eyes glittered. "Neither Frey nor anybody else. But if my father Gymir finds you here, I'm sure he'll be glad to flex his muscles."
Skirnir was undaunted. "Look again at this honed and gleaming sword. The old giant will fall to his knees before this blade. Your father is doomed to die." Then Skirnir laid down Frey's sword and raised his own staff. Gerd gazed at it spellbound.
"I will touch you, Gerd, with this magic staff. I will teach you and tame you. You must make your way to the place where you'll never meet and never talk to any man again. You will sit on the Eagle's Hill at the edge of heaven and stare down at Hell's gates. And although you must eat, all food will seem as vile to you as the sallow snake seems to them. You'll become a sight to make our blood run cold. The frost giant Hrimnir will gape at you. You'll become better known than the watchman of the gods as you peer out bleakly from your windy penthouse. Rage and longing, tears and torment will rack you. However you twist and turn, you'll not escape your fate.
troubled heart, a double portion of misery. Here in Jotunheim, spiteful spirits will pick at you and prick you every day, and every day you will crawl to the halls of frost giants, crawl for no purpose, and crawl without even hope. While others are glad, you will grieve. Your body will shake with sobs. You'll live always amongst three-headed giants, and never once sleep with a husband. May lust grip you. May despair sap you. Be like thistle tossed into the hayloft and trampled underfoot. I went to the dark wood, the dripping forest, to find a magic branch. I found this staff. The greatest of the gods, Odin, is enraged with you. Frey will lose no love for you. Gerd, worst of women, you have unleashed the wrath of all the gods. Frost giants, listen! Rock giants, listen! Sons of Suttung, listen! And hear me, gods in Asgard, I forbid this woman to meet with any man. I forbid this woman joy of any man. Hrimgrimnir, pale and unearthly in his shroud of frost, is the giant who will enjoy you in the gloom near Hell's gates. Under the roots of Yggdrasil, foul corpses will press on you horns full of piss. However great your thirst, that is the best drink there will be for you. That is my curse. Gerd, I have inscribed a charm for you, sealed to three runes, longing and raving and lust. But what I have written I can erase, if I have good reason. As she listened to Skirnir's spells, Gerd began to tremble terribly, and at length she raised her eyes slowly and gazed at her guest. Skirnir, she said, you are welcome here. Drink from this frost cup filled with mead for you. Now her eyes no longer glittered like broken ice. They were filled with tears. I never believed, she said, that I should swear to love one of the Vanir. Skirnir lowered his staff and took the frost cup. Before I ride home, I must know everything. When will you meet the son of Njord? There is a forest, Bari, that we both know well. It is beautiful there and peaceful. And there Gerd will give herself to the son of Njord 9 nights hence. Then Skirnir bowed. He took his leave of Gerd and walked out of her chilly hall. He called his horse to him, remounted, and rode swiftly back to Asgard before it was morning. Sleepless, Frey heard him coming. He stood outside his hall, impatient and anxious. Skirnir smiled and, taking his time, dismounted.
Skirnir, before you unsaddle, before you go a foot further, tell me, were you successful? Have you brought ecstasy or anguish out of Jotunheim?
The god and his servant stood in a shaft of soft orange light near the entrance of Frey's hall. Skirnir gathered his cloak around him and looked at Frey. There is a forest, Bari, that we both know well. It is beautiful there and peaceful. And there Gerd will give herself to the son of Njord 9 nights hence.
One night is long, cried Frey, and 2 nights are longer. How can I bear 3? How can I?
He raised his arms and threw back his head and closed his eyes.
Often enough I've thought a whole month shorter than half one such night, charged with this desire.
Interesting words there from Snorri Sturluson. It's kind of a weird story, isn't it? We've basically got the servant of Frey riding off into Jotunheim and threatening Gerd. If she doesn't fall in love with Frey, that she's going to have this terrible curse. Not a very feminist sort of tale, is it? I mean, what exactly is the moral of this, after all? I don't think that the story really has anything to do with real people at all, and therefore the sexist element of the story or the chauvinistic thing, it's really not a thing as far as the story is concerned. The story is really very clearly an allegory. I think that Kevin Crossley Holland sums it up admirably in his notes to the tale. It is an allegory, and it's the allegory of winter giving way to spring. We have Gerd, who her name comes from the Norse girth, which means field. So she's the frozen field. She's got the icy cup. She's got the brilliant shining of the white snow and ice. And then we have Skirnir. Now, Frey doesn't really take direct action here. Frey, of course, being the chief fertility god of the Norse pantheon. But he sends his servant, and Skirnir is based on the Norse word skir, which means shining. So Skirnir is actually a source of heat, and that's why he's able to melt Gerd, to melt her resolve, as it were, to allegorically melt that frozen field and allow it to become soft, to make it ready for planting by, of course, the fertility god himself. I don't think that this tale would have been lost on the Norse. I think that they would have realized that this isn't about literal people, and this is really an allegory about the coming of spring. And indeed, that's what it is. All right, so before I move on to the next bit, I just wanted to give a shout out here. Now, we actually are now on Stitcher. Hooray, yeah. This is something that I've been planning on doing for a while, and I finally gotten around to it. The podcast is now available on Stitcher. Stitcher, of course, is a free podcast app for your phone or your other device, and you can download it and have podcasts for free. And I'm hoping that this will bring us a little bit more of an audience anyway. And, you know, it's been something I've been planning for a while. I think we're going to see a little bit more of a push in the next few months. I'm going to be trying to get on more platforms and that kind of thing. Try to get the name out there a little bit more. I think that's one of the things I'm really bad at is self-promotion. And so I'm hoping that, you know, we can actually get a few more listeners and kind of broaden the number of people that actually are in contact with us and actually have access to the podcast. So Stitcher is just the first step, and hopefully there will be many more to follow. And boy, are we lucky that I'm even here this week, folks. I mean, I thought that I wasn't going to be able to record anything because I was having some major, major, major computer problems. And I did say, you know, on Facebook, I said, I'm not sure if I'm going to get a show out, but I'm very, very glad that we did, even though it's a little bit of a short show. Certainly, it's going to be better than nothing, as I put it. So next I'm going to do something I don't normally do, and I'm going to do another one of the Norse myths. Now, this is a short one, and I'm going to preface it, actually, rather than do the explanation afterwards. This is a really interesting story. It's the story of Gylfi and Gefion, and it's one of those pieces of folklore that is really kind of a national myth. It's one of these national legends. In this case, it's one of the national legends of Denmark. And of course, Denmark, we already know, traces its descent back to the gods. The two earliest kings of Denmark, Dan and Denp, had traced their lineage from Heimdall himself, as we talked about in the Song of Rig. And this is another little piece of the Denmark puzzle here. A little piece of lore that we call Gylfi and Gefion.
"You have treated me like a king," said Gylfi. The wizened beggar woman sat in her cocoon of filthy, reeking rags and listened. "Our bed was only this bare ground," said Gylfi, "and our roof was only this whispering tree and the litter of stars beyond. But all that you had to share, your scraps of food, your store of understanding, you willingly offered." The beggar woman's eyes were deep wells, unfathomable and strangely gleaming. "You have treated me like a king," Gylfi said, "and now I want to tell you that I am the king." The beggar woman looked at Gylfi without changing her expression. She sniffed. "As you shared with me, I will share with you," said Gylfi. "You are welcome to as much of Sweden as you can plow with four oxen in one day and one night." Then the king and the beggar woman went their own ways. Gylfi found and followed a track out of the forest and came back to his court. The beggar woman, none other than the goddess Gefion, left Midgard and journeyed into Jotunheim. Gefion walked past cauldrons of mud and boiling springs. She worked her way around the base of a mountain and reached a secluded, fertile valley. No man lived there,
but four huge oxen were grazing under the hot sun, the four sons of the goddess and the giant. Gefion took her sons with her back to Midgard and into the country of Sweden. She chose a piece of land very fine to look at and even better for farming, and yoked the four oxen to a massive plow. Now the coulter bit so deep that it began to loosen the crust of the earth. Now the oxen strained with every sinew and muscle and wrenched the mold away from the molten rock beneath. Gefion laughed as her four sons dragged off a great piece of land. The oxen slowly made their way westward. They reeked with sweat. The goddess urged them on, and they waded into the sea, still hauling the land behind them, until at last they stopped in the middle of a sound.
"Leave the land here," Gefion said. "Let it lie here until the end of the world."
She unyoked the oxen from the plow. Oxen with eyes like moons, not unlike their mother.
"And let this fertile island be known as Zealand," said the goddess.
So Gefion repaid Gylfi's generosity by looting his land. That which made Denmark larger made Sweden smaller. Water oozed from the earth and fell from the sky into the gaping wound where the land had been ripped up and became a lake. Men called it Molar. And that is why the headlands of Zealand fit in the inlets and bays and the bights of Lake Molar. I always find it really interesting when you have a piece of mythology or a piece of lore that actually purports to be a factual history of a real place. And I just find that kind of syncretism just incredibly cool. And that's one of the things that really fascinates me about Iceland, in a way, in the various links that Robert has posted on the Facebook page, you know, where they have the valley, which is the hoofprint of Sleipnir. I find that stuff really interesting and really want to go see these places because I think it's pretty cool. Now, what's interesting about this story is that there's two different versions of it. And even though Kevin Crossley Howland chose to adapt only one of them, Snorri Sturluson actually gives us this myth twice. First in the Prose Edda, which is where that version came from, and then later in the Heimskringla. And the version in the Heimskringla is actually completely different. You still have Gylfi and you still have Gefion, but the circumstances of the stealing of the land from Sweden is completely different. And Kevin Crossley Howland, he summarizes it here in the notes. And I'm just going to go ahead and read from the notes. And so we get both versions, at least, in the show. In the Yngling saga, Snorri describes Odin as king of Aesland in Asia. Yeah, this was a little bit of a problem because Snorri, of course, was a Christian. He didn't believe that Odin, Thor, and so forth were real gods. He thought of them more as historical figures. Because of Odin's power of foresight, he knows that his descendants will live, quote-unquote, in the northern part of the world. He makes his way through Russia to North Germany, establishes his sons as rulers there, and settles on an island called Odense in Fyn. Odin then dispatches Gefion further north in search of new land. King Gylfi gives her ground, and her motive in dragging the land out of Sweden appears to be to add to Odin's realm, although Odin himself subsequently moves on to the present-day Sigtuna in Uppsalafjord. An additional difference between the two versions is that in the Heimskringla, Gefion has to travel to Jotunheim to bear four sons to a giant and then transforms them into oxen, whereas in the Prose Edda, her sons have already been born and are, so to speak, already. Snorri rounds off both versions by quoting a verse from the 9th century Ragnarsdrapa by Bragi the Old, which describes the reeking sweat of the oxen and Gefion's laughter as she steals Gylfi's land to make Denmark larger. It is interesting. There's a few other details given about the goddess Gefion, who's not a major goddess in the Norse lore. She's actually, I mean, this is probably the only story that we have about her. There are a couple of mentions of her elsewhere. In the Lokasenna, Loki accuses her of selling her body for a necklace, and Odin says that she knows the future. She's a fertility goddess, obviously, and in a lot of ways, according to Kevin Crossley Holland, she combines the qualities of Freyja and Frigg. In the Heimskringla, Snorri says the Gefjun married the god king Skjold, the son of Odin, and lived in Lyra in Denmark, where it was known she had a sanctuary. I've actually been to Lyra. There's an Iron Age village reconstruction there. It's kind of a very pastoral place there. It's kind of a really beautiful part of Denmark. All right, and with that, I'm going to wrap up the show for this week. Once again, folks, thanks very much for listening. We'll be back to our normal schedule next week, hopefully, barring any computer problems I may have in the meantime. I think I've got it nailed down now, but you never know. So hopefully that's all been fixed now, and we'll be back to normal next week. All right, and with that, I am back over the Rainbow Bridge, sliding down the Rainbow Bridge back to Midgard, and we'll see you next week here on Radio Free Asgard. You have been listening to Radio Free Asgard, a production of Tom Harris USA Productions, which is totally responsible for its content. The Mighty Thor and all associated characters are mostly copyright Marvel Comics. The stories presented are done so for educational, review, and entertainment purposes only. No ownership is implied. The silly voices, however, well, they're all me. Musical selections from Eden, the Invincible Sword of the Elfsmith, are copyright Mots Vent and are used with permission. If you like what you've heard on the show, we hope you'll leave us a review on iTunes, tell your friends, or even join our Facebook group. We really love hearing from our listeners, and we appreciate all of your support. Thanks once again very much for listening to Radio Free Asgard.